For 30 years, Carl Hiaasen has been writing crime novels about the freaks and scumballs of South Florida. I'll talk to him about his new book, where he once again turns his anger at corruption and environmental evildoers into comedy.
A lot of the funniest writers I know have a deep vein of anger, and they're writing for a reason.
Later in the hour, I'll talk with Weird Al Yankovic, a perfectly sunny guy whose satirical targets welcome his attentions. He's so nice, he asks permission to make fun of people. Plus, we'll get an exclusive preview of Jack Handy's new novel.
I was making good progress on my novel, Muscular Angry Clown. It's about a well-built circus clown with a hot temper.
That and much more is ahead in today's hour of Comic Virtuosos in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC, right after this.
Support for Studio 360 comes from Scion, celebrating 10 years of making their own tracks with the limited edition Scion 10 models. Arriving this summer with exclusive Scion 10 features. You can learn more and download Scion's 10-year anniversary music release at scion.com.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. In the music business, there are gold records, there are Grammys, and then if you're really successful, there's a parody by Weird Al Yankovic.
As I walk through the valley where I harvest my grain, I take a look at my wife and realize she's very plain. But that's just perfect for an Amish like me. You
know, it's sort of a signal that an artist has reached a certain plateau in their career, you know, so it's just part of the triumvirate there.
We've been spending most our lives living in an Amish paradise.
Weird Al Yankovic joins me in Studio 360 for a live performance. That's coming up later in the hour. But first, when news of the National Security Agency's vast data mining program broke earlier this month, Americans found out the extent to which the government had been collecting and analyzing their phone records and internet activity. Days after the government's massive surveillance program came to light, 1984, George Orwell's novel about a dystopia run by Big Brother, had this huge spike in sales. CNN reported that sales jumped by almost 10,000%. Even President Obama referred to 1984 in a speech he gave defending the NSA program.
In the abstract, you can complain about Big Brother and how this is a potential program run amok. But when you actually look at the details, then I think we've struck the right balance.
A lot of us have been thinking about Big Brother, including the writer Walter Kern. Among other novels, he's the author of The Unbinding, a look at the dangers of the surveillance state, and he has been writing about the implications of the NSA programs in the New Republic. Walter, welcome back to Studio 360.
Hi there. Glad to be back.
So did the news, this news of the NSA data mining and its vastness, shock you or alarm you?
Well, I move among people who are suspicious and imaginative by nature, so I think there was a sense that something like this was probably going on.
And how has the idea of and the reality of surveillance evolved from 1949, when Orwell published 1984, to now and nowish, as you were writing about it?
Well, Big Brother was a monolithic dictatorial leader who seemed to have power for life or something like that. He was very interested in their love lives and in disrupting any attachment that they might have to anything but the state. But what we're doing now is we're communicating and using all these technologies which themselves, you know, have surveillance capabilities. We're taking pictures of each other. We're taking pictures of ourselves. We're dumping our private information onto Facebook, etc. We're divulging a lot more than we used to, and it's being collected and sifted.
Speaking of 1984, I want to play a clip from a BBC docudrama. This is an actor reading from the novel.
There will be no emotions except fear, rage, triumph, and self-abasement. The sex instinct will be eradicated. We shall abolish the orgasm. There will be no loyalty except loyalty to the party. But always there will be the intoxication of power. Always, at every moment, there will be the thrill of victory, the sensation of trampling on an enemy who is helpless. If you want a picture of the future, imagine a boot stamping on a human face forever. The moral to be drawn from this dangerous nightmare situation is a simple one. Don't let it happen. It depends on you.
When one sees Mr. Snowden, the leaker in this, and hears his statements, it's as though he has channeled himself into being the hero that is encouraged by Orwell in 1984.
Yes, he has. It makes him a slightly anachronistic character, actually, because he's more than a whistleblower. He's holding himself out as kind of, you know, the last free and honest individual who's trying to save the rest of us from our lemming-like rush over the cliff.
And until, I guess, and unless the national security state and its massive surveillance begins being actively tyrannical against people who aren't plotting terrorist acts, we'll continue to go, yeah, whatever.
Well, here's what scares me. You know, we're now in the recording phase of surveillance. In other words, our information is being grabbed, sifted, stored. We're not yet in the playback phase. You know, this vast archive of information is being built up. And at some point, I think there may be a temptation to compete for control of it among people who would want power in society. I don't think we've really explored the possibilities of what could go wrong.
President Obama has said more than once he's glad we're having this debate now. Do you think as a result of this conversation, this debate, that there will be any rollback of this sort of surveillance paradigm?
I can't say I'm optimistic that there will be a rollback. What I think there will be is a change of consciousness on the part of the general public as they begin to assume that this is status quo and react accordingly. You know, once it sinks in that you're being watched or might be being recorded, you start to behave differently. And the inhibition of normal life is what I fear.
Well, we used to all think that God was aware of everything we did or thought, and now I guess that consciousness will be replaced by this sense that Big Brother is aware of everything we do.
If it was God watching me, I'd figure that he's kind of merciful and has a broad view of human behavior. When it's my fellow man in all his sort of selfishness and you know, flawedness watching me, I'm a little more fearful.
It's the Greek gods. It's not God. It's the Greek gods.
Exactly. It's the capricious, changing gods.
1984 is the iconic font about this. Are there other works of fiction or movies that you think are apt as we're having this conversation?
You know, I'm thinking of one, and this might sound a little odd, but I'm thinking of the movie 2001, A Space Odyssey. I sort of feel like that ship controlled by the HAL computer is a good metaphor for what we're coming toward, which is a sort of automated society in which we question our own judgment versus the machine and might at someday have to turn it off. Will we be able to? And will at that point it have so many responsibilities and be so in control that to turn it off will be to sort of threaten our own, you know, well-being?
I couldn't agree with you more. And Hal, by the way, wasn't evil. He was just trying to perform the mission as it had been programmed.
Well, and that's another thing. Because 1984 had an evil and dark leader, we can't forget that even leaders that are, you know, supposedly following our best interests can end up creating a situation of some, you know, troubling dimensions.
Walter Kern, it has been a pleasure, as always, talking with you. Thank you.
Thank you, Kurt.
Walter Kern is a writer. His most recent book is Lost in the Meritocracy. So what do you think? Is Orwell's Big Brother the apt fictional vision in the age of big data? Leave us a comment at studio360.org.
The moral to be drawn from this dangerous nightmare situation is a simple one. Don't let it happen. It depends on you.
Someday they won't let you. Now you must agree. The times they are a-telling and the changing isn't free. You've read it in the tea leaves and the cracks are on TV. Beware the savage shore. 1984.
For the 94% of us Americans who don't live in Florida, our sense of the place has been powerfully shaped during the last 20 years or so by one man, Carl Hiaasen. You think Florida is a zany, grotesque place full of grifters and nutballs and sleazy developers and politicians? That is Carl Hiaasen's doing. He was born and raised there and lives there still, and for pretty much his entire career has also written for the Miami Herald. His latest novel is called Bad Monkey. It's the story of a failing police detective trying to salvage his career by solving the mystery of a severed arm found floating off Key West.
Yancey knew the sheriff was sending the arm to Miami because Miami was the floating human body parts capital of America. Maybe they'd luck out and find a match, although Yancey thought it was unlikely.
Carl Hiaasen, welcome to Studio 360.
Thanks for having me.
So Bad Monkey's main character is this guy, Andrew Yancey. Tell us about him.
Well, Yancey is a cop, sort of imagines himself a hotshot detective in the Keys, Monroe County. And he gets in some trouble, romantic trouble, ends up losing his badge and they demote him. But he's trying to get back on the regular police force by solving this arm is floated and it was caught by a tourist on a fishing boat. And everyone thinks it's obviously a victim of a boating accident, somebody that got hit in the propeller or whatever. And he's suspicious. And so he sets off and the arm ends up in his freezer, in his personal in the freezer with the popsicles for a great length of time. And he feels now an obligation to it.
The book's bad guy is this fraudulent Medicare profiteer, and you call in the book South Florida America's Medicare fraud capital.
Yeah, it is.
Which you've also written about in columns.
Yes.
Medicare fraud. Do you at this point think of your day job as a kind of R&D's end of your fiction writing?
That's absolutely true, Kurt. I mean, I probably couldn't write the novels I write if I didn't at least have one toe in the newsroom. And in the sense, not that I'm physically there, but I'm writing and I'm engaged and I'm reading all the different newspapers in Florida. And so this constant over-the-transom flow of sleaze inspires the novel. It can't help to. It also keeps you angry enough because you know that. I mean, a lot of the funniest writers I know, funniest people I know, have a deep vein of anger, and it's a sense of sort of ironic outrage at things. And they're not happy-go-lucky people. I mean, they're writing for a reason. If you go back, Mark Twain was not a sunny personality most of the time. So this is how you get it out.
And for a guy who writes very angrily a lot, you don't seem angry at all. Maybe you get it out in your writing.
I get it. I mean, it's pure. I tell people it's psychotherapy for me. I'd do it if I didn't have to do it, I think. And I have been since. I mean, the feeling started when I was very young. I mean, I was 5 or 6 when they started paving my childhood, right? You know, the boom years of Florida back in the late 50s, early 60s, all throughout, just watching it disappear. Even as a kid, you have a sense of outrage. I don't know, you didn't know politically how did this happen? How did they do it? But it still pissed you off.
Yep.
And so I vented from an early age and I got lucky and later went to work for the newspaper and got a newspaper column eventually and I got to vent there a lot. But the books are good too because I get to write my own endings on the books.
you called South Florida in one of your recent columns the poster child for national dysfunction. Why is that? Why so much weirdness and rot in this one place? And at this point, as I said at the outset, thanks partly to you, all of America regards Florida as this special, unfortunate case.
It's always been a land where dreamers have come. And when you have people with a dream and with an image and sort of an iconic sense of we're going to move down there and everything's going to be fine, you also have a predatory element that moves with it. I've always told people, I said, if you are a car thief, for example, if you steal cars for a living, would you rather steal cars in Detroit, Michigan in January or on Miami Beach in January? Where would you rather be?
Yeah.
So it makes sense.
Now, other than the fact that you like to play golf or at least you've written about playing golf and you like to fish, does it ever strike you as odd that you choose to live in this place that you have made a career sort of savaging and satirizing?
Yeah, I've been trying to scare people away from Florida for literally 35 years, and I still get letters from readers saying, we love your books, but please don't be mad. We're moving to Florida anyway. where else? I mean, I really have roots. I love the place enough to stay and fight. It'd be easy to bail out and move to, Santa Fe or something and put on some clogs and walk around and look at the art galleries or whatever. But I can't do that. You can't disengage. It's the same way so many writers are connected to New York.
Right. Even despite its expense, its difficulty, and all that.
Frustrations and all the headaches. They could never pull themselves away to be creative somewhere else. Yeah. And that's sort of the way I feel.
The Demi Moore movie, Striptease, was an adaptation of your novel.
Mm.
As a chronicler of eccentrics and sleaze, how did Hollywood stack up against South Florida?
They were very nice to me. Everybody was. Demi was everything. I went in with very modest expectations, if I can put it like that. When you have a nightclub in the book called The Eager Beaver, this is not Citizen Kane material. I never went in with that thinking that.
Citizen Kane wasn't Citizen Kane material.
Right. But I always tell people, say, oh, but I didn't look what they did to your book. And I said, they didn't do anything to my book.
Right.
They made a movie.
Exactly.
You can pick the book out of the shelf in the library and it's the same book. You can't take it too seriously. I know writers that have been completely poleaxed by the whole Hollywood experience, and they take it so intensely and personally.
But just go in with zero expectations.
No, and also the whole process is satirical in many ways. Meetings and the notes you get if you can't laugh, you'll go out of your mind.
I was happy to see on your bio on your website that you say of that film, Burt Reynolds slathered from neck to toes with Vaseline is one of the golden moments in modern American cinema. Your fellow Floridian.
Yeah,
Burt Reynolds.
He was a trip on the set, I'll tell you. And he was very nice to me. But that one scene, which was right out of the book, and I had modeled his character after my own congressman who had gotten busted in a strip joint. I just poached it from the headlines. And the guy passed away right before the movie came out. And I always felt bad because he would have been so flattered. He looked nothing like Burt Reynolds, I can assure you. I think Herb Burke was his name. I think he would have been very thrilled to have been portrayed even the way Burt did it.
Do you run in, speaking of that guy, or Burt Reynolds for that matter, do you run into people whom you've satirized and savaged?
No, that's the great thing about being a writer is that you're so solitary and cantankerous and unpleasant to be around. There's very little social life.
And you're not even in Miami anymore.
No, I'm not in Miami. I go down there to see my grandkids and most of the people I write about would not want to be in the same room with me. So it's not
how
really,
nice for you.
It's never really been a problem.
You published quite a few novels before your big commercial breakthrough, Striptease. That is a lot of writing and publishing to do before the world says, my God, you're this great best-selling novelist. Did you ever get close to saying, maybe this isn't working out?
Never, because you know what? I always had great – you know what it's like when the box of books comes. You busted your ass writing this thing, and then months go by. It's like this gestation, and then the books come, and it's still a big high to do it.
Yeah.
And I never felt like giving up because the other thing is I had to do it, Kurt. I was working in the newsroom all day then, and then on the investigations team where we didn't write that much.
Right.
You might write once every 3 or 4 months on a project. So you get all this writing energy built up, and the books were what got me through that. So I wouldn't have stopped no matter how many rejection letters.
You felt fortunate to be published?
I still do.
Yeah.
Still do.
Carl Hyacin, this has been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me. It's great fun.
Carl Hyacin's new novel, Bad Monkey, is out right now, and you can hear more from the audiobook of Bad Monkey at studio360.org. Still ahead this hour, we're in the middle of a new listener challenge, a kind of back to the future battle of the high school band. We're asking you to send us the best song you made when you were in high school, no matter when you were in high school. And our inbox is already overflowing with submissions. I'll check in with Tao Nguyen, one of our rock star judges, and we'll listen to some of our favorite entries so far. That's ahead in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
Support for Studio 360 comes from the car company Scion, dedicated to supporting new talent. At the Scion Motivate Conference, 10 young entrepreneurs were awarded a car, capital, and mentoring. One awardee was Notes for Notes, a nonprofit program in Nashville providing music education to kids. Learn more at scion.com.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. A few weeks ago, we kicked off our latest Extra Credit Listener Contest. It's Studio 360's Battle of the High School Bands.
I used to have Rock Band back in high school.
Battle of the High School Bands.
We want you to send us the best piece of music you and your friends made between your freshman and senior years of high school. Any genre, any decade, so long as you didn't do it as part of school. No marching bands, for instance. Your deadline is Sunday, July 21st. Andrew W.K. and Tao Nguyen are the judges, and Andrew and Tao have agreed to collaborate on a cover recording of the winning song, which is the most serious prize we've ever given for one of these contests. We've already gotten dozens of songs, and Tao joins me now to listen to a few of those entries. Tao, welcome back to Studio 360.
Good to be back.
One of the things that has been most pleasantly surprising to me about the songs we've heard is that they span the last half century. I want to start by listening to the most vintage entry so far. It's called Don't Cry, and it was recorded in 1967.
My summer baby said to myself, now don't cry, don't cry. Just yesterday she said that I'm not the right guy, right guy. Well, I said to myself, there are other girls around.
I have never felt more like a DJ. That was Don't Cry by The Cinch, recorded in 1967 in Michigan. The band went to Gros Isle High School on the Detroit River. Really, such a time-traveling little experience. I feel 12 years old again.
That was fantastic, and really impressive guitar playing. Quite the shredder. I wish I'd played that well in high school, or ever, actually.
And it seems like a pretty complex production mix.
It does. It sounds like a recording that from that time period that would have accelerated beyond
Gros Isle
high school production. Right. Yes, exactly.
I want to listen to something a little more contemporary now. These are Brooklyn high schoolers who called themselves New Genre. And the song recorded in 2011 is called Lonely Hearts Club.
It's a bright, sunny day and it feels so cold.
I think that production is so smooth. I was sort of slinking around in my office chair. Again, really impressive. I can't believe that it's made in the high school years.
I know.
Sweet rhymes. I like the hype man.
Yeah. Well, and if it were to be the winner, I guess you and Andrew would have to trade those longing verses back and forth as you covered it.
Certainly. We would do so with zest and fervor, but I would try to be the lower voice.
There you go. That's the way to get around it. So we've got old stuff that sounds old, and we've got new stuff that sounds new. But in this age, of course, there are newish ones that sound as if they belong to some very specific bygone era. I want to play one of those. It's called I Hate the Pharmacy. That's by a band called Pocket Aristotle from Des Moines. I want you to try to guess the year it was made.
I can't wait to hear the real answer. I wouldn't get, judging from the way it sounds and the way it made me feel and the nostalgia that immediately enveloped me, I would say 93.
I would have said about the same thing, but it's from 2011. But they told us that they were heavily influenced by, quote, the North Carolina alt-rock scene of the 90s.
I don't know exactly who is in the North Carolina alt-rock scene.
Well, if you don't, I really don't. To show that we've had this incredible range of submissions, this one is by a band called The Villain from my home state of Nebraska, which they performed in 2006. It's called The Lair.
Yeah.
Yes, this is your public radio metal station. What do you think?
As someone who's never really listened to metal, it's not entirely in my wheelhouse, but
right.
I do acknowledge that it's really incredible musicianship. And
although there would be definitely something interesting about a Tao Wynn cover of that.
You know, it's going to be a little bit more down-tempo.
Yeah. So now that you've heard some of what's been coming in, do you have any advice to contestants who have not yet entered?
Well, I think now that they've heard the caliber of entries, you know, of course we want to hear everything that you've done, but just keep in mind that this is what you're up against. And I almost feel, you know, now if I go back and listen to the things I made in high school, I don't even know if I'm qualified to be a judge of this contest.
People should not be scared away if they don't have a super high production value, because if it's a great vibe, we'll give it the full benefit of the doubt.
Yeah. As someone who is elementary at best as a sound engineer and recording my own demos and such, I think both Andrew and I will have great compassion for the quality of the song over the quality of the production.
Great.
We have the imagination to see and to hear the potential of it.
Perfect. Tao, thank you very much.
Thank you so much. Good to talk to you again, Kurt.
Stir it up!
Tao Wynn of Tao and the Get Down, Stay Down is judging Studio 360's Battle of the High School Bands, along with Andrew W.K. They want to hear your music. So don't be shy. Go upload your adolescent best right now. All the contest details are at studio360.org/myhighschoolband.
Sliding on the grass and you're moving really fast, that's frictional force.
Yes. Whenever I see an old lady slip and fall on a wet sidewalk, my first instinct is to laugh. But then I think, what if I was an ant and she fell on me? Then it wouldn't seem quite so funny.
It has been more than 20 years since Jack Handy started sharing his deep thoughts on Saturday Night Live. Since then, he's published several books and contributes humor regularly to the New Yorker magazine. And now he is publishing an actual novel. Or, him being Jack Handy, sort of an actual novel. Here and only here, he is reading an excerpt from his new book, The Stench of Honolulu.
When my friend Don suggested we go on a trip to the South Seas together and offered to pay for the whole thing, I thought, fine, but what's in it for me? After he explained that I'd be getting a free vacation, I still hesitated. It was true that, job-wise, I had some time. I had just been fired again. And after working there for nearly 2 months, I was ready for a vacation. But finally I said no. For one thing, I don't really like the tropics. The last time I went to the Caribbean, I wound up in a bongo factory, forced to make bongos. Also, I was making good progress on my novel, Muscular Angry Clown. It's about a well-built circus clown with a hot temper. I was at the part where he breaks the neck of the evil lion tamer. Also, I had been dating this woman, and we were really being in love. I can't remember her name right now, but she's great. I knew Don would ask me again. He doesn't have a lot of good friends. That's because he doesn't hang around in bars a lot, like I do. That's where you make your really good friends, in bars. Sure enough, Don called again. He said the reason for the trip was that his divorce had become final. And he wanted to go someplace far away. And he wanted me to go because he had a bunch of different emotions, and he wanted someone to share them with. That was when I pretended something was wrong with the phone and hung up. When Don called back, I used my Chinese voice and said, "Hino here." Why then, you're wondering, did I call Don back and agree to go on the trip with him? Someone lit a fire under me. And that someone was the Flamia brothers. They dragged me into an alley and lit a fire under me. They said that if I didn't pay them the money I owed them, they would put a device on my head. What kind of device? I said. Not a device, a vice.
After I agreed to go, there were ominous warning signs. I got a letter addressed to Occupant, but someone had crossed it out and written Resident. I saw my name in a bowl of spaghetti, misspelled. I dreamed I was in the jungle, holding a lighted stick of dynamite. I tried to throw it, but it stuck in my hand. Then I noticed the brand name, Sticky Dynamite. I woke up in a cold sweat. Scariest of all was the hideous old crone. She pointed her long, crooked finger at Don and me and croaked,
Do not go on this trip.
There is nothing but death and destruction. Then she said, but if you do go, I can get you a really good deal. All we had to do was connect through St. Louis.
Please make sure your seat backs and tray tables are in their upright position. Next stop, Honolulu.
That's Jack Handy reading from The Stench of Honolulu. And because June is officially Jack Handy Month in Studio 360, we'll feature some more bits of him and his novel during the next few weeks. But coming up right now is Weird Al Yankovic. We'll talk, and he'll play a straight-ahead, no-joke cover of a certain classic hit song. That's next in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
I'm nerdy and the extreme and whiter than sour cream. I was in AV club and glee club and even the chess team. Only question I ever thought was hard. What do I like, Kirk, or do I like Picard? Spend every weekend at the Renaissance Fair. Got my name on my underwear.
Support for Studio 360 comes from the car company Scion, dedicated to supporting new talent. At the Scion Motivate Conference, 10 young entrepreneurs were awarded a car, capital, and mentoring. One awardee was Wonderheads, a Portland theater company specializing in mask performances. Learn more at scion.com.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. Back in my younger days, I spent a lot of time doing parodies. In college at the Harvard Lampoon, and then at Spy Magazine, parodies in print. Fortunately, I'm not a musician or a filmmaker, because otherwise I would have been incredibly jealous of my next guest's talent and success. Just about exactly 30 years ago, Weird Al Yankovic released his debut album, which included that parody of Joan Jett's I Love Rock and Roll. Funny novelty records were nothing new, but they and their performers came and went pretty quickly. Whereas this album sold 500,000 copies, and its follow-up, In 3D, went platinum. That one featured Yankovic's Michael Jackson parody, Eat It. And in a little while, today, we're going to hear a special live unplugged version of that song. But before we do, we're going to talk. Al Yankovic, welcome. It is such a pleasure to have you in Studio 360.
Thank you, Kurt. Great to be here.
So you have been around long enough to parody Billy Ray Cyrus and his daughter, Miley, Madonna and her daughter, Lady Gaga. Not only do you have multiple generations of fans, but the artists you parody have come to see your music as more than just some stunt. Lady Gaga called your parody of her song Born This Way a rite of passage. I want to play just a little bit of that song.
I'm so completely original. My new look is all the rage. Wrap my small intestines round my neck and set fire to myself on stage. I'll wear a porcupine on my head.
So at this point, not that you've been ever a vicious satirist, but how does it feel to be this kind of elder statesman, some kind of bizarro world version of Ed Sullivan and Dick Clark?
It's a very odd thing because, yeah, it's sort of a signal that an artist has reached a certain plateau in their career. You know, they've got the Grammys, they've got the platinum albums, then they get the Weird Al parody. So it's just part of the triumvirate there.
So you're a little younger than I am, but it's the 60s, it's the early 70s, and rock and roll is happening, and Hendrix is happening, and Dylan is happening. This guitar revolution of rock and roll takes itself very seriously in many ways. And you have an accordion and start writing parodies. How did that happen?
Well, oddly enough, my friends actually didn't want me in their rock bands with an accordion.
Really?
They weren't ahead of the curve. They didn't realize that the accordion would take over Western civilization the way that it obviously has.
There were no hipsters to rediscover it yet.
You know, I was the original hipster, I'm sorry to say, yeah. Yes.
And at what point did you decide, well, the accordion is funny?
Well, I didn't intend it to be funny, but, you know, I love rock and roll, and I'd learn songs off the radio and play it, you know, on the accordion, and my friends would think there was humor in that. They thought the juxtaposition was ridiculous, and I didn't think quite so much, but I found that other people did, and I kind of used that to my advantage.
I started playing Doors songs on the trumpet. If I'd only understood what you understood. You jokingly say you're the original hipster, but the hipsters of right now are all embracing you. You've done on Cartoon Network, Robot Chicken, Tim and Eric Awesome Show, 30 Rock. Do you go to them and strategize of, oh, I want the cool kids to like me, or do they come to you?
You know, it's hard to proactively try to be cool or relevant.
It's the opposite of cool.
It kind of happens if it happens. So I don't know. You know, for a long stretch of my career, I wasn't considered cool. In fact, my manager will tell you stories about when I was starting out, he couldn't get his phone calls returned. He'd say, hi, I represent Weird Al Yankovic. And they'd say, oh, I'm so sorry.
Really?
So
even after you'd had hits?
You know, I had to have a lot of hits before I stopped being considered a one-hit wonder.
Then you were a two-hit wonder and a six-hit
wonder. Right, right. And then after all, oh, he's not going away, is he? Oh, okay.
Yeah. And you won 3 Grammy Awards. Your first one in 1984 was for Eat It,
uh-huh.
Named Best Comedy Record. And anybody who was alive then will remember the music video. It is a shot-for-shot parody of Michael Jackson's video for Beat It. The arrival of MTV just when you essentially, as you were starting out, is an incredibly fortuitous thing, right?
Yeah, I was sort of an outlier in that sense because, yeah, MTV and I started out at the same time. And when MTV started out, people were obsessed with it. I mean, you know, it was a 24-hour music video channel. People hadn't seen anything like that before. And, you know, I was certainly one of those people that would watch MTV for hours and hours every day. And the hit videos were things people were intimately familiar with. You knew every shot of those videos. So that made my job very easy because all you had to do was tweak things a little bit and people instantly knew what direction you were going.
Right. Well, let's go back in time to that moment and hear our special unplugged version of Eat It performed live right here.
Such a fussy young man. Don't want no Captain Crunch. Don't want no Raisin Bran. Well, don't you know that other kids are starving in Japan? So eat it, just eat it. Don't wanna argue, I don't wanna debate. Don't wanna hear about what kind of food you hate. You won't get no dessert till you clean off your plate, so eat it. Don't you tell me you're full, just eat it. Eat it. Get yourself an egg and beat it. Have some more chicken, have some more pie. It doesn't matter if it's boiled or fried, just eat it. Table manners are a crying shame. You're playing with your food, this ain't some kind of game. Now if you starve to death, you'll just have yourself to blame. So eat it, just eat it. You better listen, better do what you're told. You haven't even touched your tuna casserole. Chow down, or it's gonna get cold, so eat it. I don't care if you're full, just eat it.
Eat it.
Eat it. If it's getting cold, reheat it. Have a big dinner, have a light snack.
That was Weird Al Yankovic and his band performing live the ultimate modern pop parody, Eat It. You sort of, in this unplugged way, you've sort of turned it into a Clapton-esque, Layla-like thing.
Yes, that was actually something that we had done for MTV in the late 90s. They wanted to do a parody spot based on the fact that I had kind of changed my look at that time, and their Unplugged series was obviously very popular. So we did this mock commercial for our new sound, and we did these Eric Clapton-esque versions of our hits.
I've always loved, and every time I've heard that song, I chuckle still at the phrase tuna casserole being in a rock and roll song.
And one of the first times, I believe.
I think. And can you introduce this greatest cover band on earth?
Yes. Over there on keys, Ruben Valtierra, Jim Kimo West on guitar, Steve Jay on bass, and John Bermuda Schwartz on drums.
I mentioned earlier, you've got multiple generations of fans at this point, and now keeping that going into yet new generations, you are a very successful children's book author with a new one coming out this week.
That's right. It's called My New Teacher and Me.
And what's that story?
It's the story of Billy, who is the star of my first book, When I Grow Up. And he's a very imaginative kid. And
He's a liar. He's a pathological liar.
Well, I wouldn't say that. It remains to be seen whether he's lying about his stories or not. But he's got a very wild imagination. And that doesn't quite mesh with his new teacher, Mr. Booth, who's a very by-the-book teacher without much of a sense of humor or sense of imagination. And they don't quite see it eye to eye. So it's a little bit about the antagonism between the two of those.
And in My New Teacher and Me, there's a page where Billy is defending himself against this grumpy literalist teacher. And he says, "Why get upset if somebody like me tries to look at the world just a bit differently?" When you were a little kid, were your parents like that teacher, or did they like let you run free and pursue creativity in whatever way you wanted?
Well, they were always very supportive of whatever I wanted to do. So I wouldn't say that I had free rein, but I mean, they always just encouraged me to find my muse. You know, I graduated with a degree in architecture, but they weren't freaked out at all when I said, "Yeah, you know, I think I want to try to, like, you know, do funny music for a living."
Yeah. Well, architects make no money anyway, so what the hell? It was two loser professions you had to choose from. You are now working on a new album, I hear?
I am. Yes, we're about halfway done with it.
Written and recorded?
We have three songs that are completely done. We have three songs that are recorded and are in the process of being mixed. And I have six songs which have not been conceptualized yet.
Do you say before records come out what songs you're doing?
I do not. It's a secret. A lot of comedy is a surprise. So yes. I like people to be as surprised as possible when they hear it for the first time.
And when as you're picking songs to do parodies of, do you have like a team of Weird Al interns who are just combing through all the different genres and say, "This is a hit. This is about to become a hit."
Oh, you know, I do not. I don't have a whole office full of people saying, "You know what you should do." No, I just personally go through the Billboard charts and go online, and I kind of make a master list of songs that I think are good candidates for parody. And then I try to think of every possible variation on a theme and see if there's anything that, you know, has some kind of spark where I can develop it into a full 3.5 minute long pop song.
Would you be willing to take suggestions from our listeners?
No.
Okay, good. Good.
I don't, because that's the bane of my existence. Every day of my life, people say, "I got this great idea. I've been holding onto it since the third grade." It's like, "Oh, you should do this." So I tell people right off the bat, like, you know, I don't really take ideas from people.
What do you listen to at home or in your car?
A little bit of everything. I've got a 10-year-old daughter, so we mostly listen to what she wants to listen to in the car. But she's pretty
again warped. And again and again.
Yes, it's true. But I mean, thankfully, she's about as warped as me. And for about a 1 month period, we listened to "They're Coming to Take Me Away, Ha Ha" nonstop.
Really?
In the car.
Clearly, you introduced that to her.
Oh,
which
yes,
was the great novelty comic song of my childhood.
Yeah, that was in fact, I'm going to see Jerry Samuels, who's Napoleon the 14th, pretty soon. He runs a rest home now. So I'm going to.
Is that sad or not?
No, I mean, he's doing what he loves as well. I'm going to visit the people there pretty soon.
Really?
Yeah.
I understand, because I've never heard a recording of it, but you do a version of Elvis Costello's Radio Radio?
I do. You know, we do. That's sort of our emergency song, meaning that if there's anything that happens on stage, the computer server goes down or something that makes it impossible for us to continue, we stop the show and say, "Ladies and gentlemen, there's no reason to go on with this. Radio, radio." And then we just go into that. So it's if you ever hear that in one of our live shows, it means something has gone horribly wrong.
Can we declare this a special emergency?
Let's do that. Here we go.
One, two, three, four. my radio advise. With every one of those late night stations playing songs, bringing tears to my eyes. I was seriously thinking about hiding the receiver when the switch broke, 'cause it's old. They're saying things that I can hardly believe. They really think we're getting out of control. Radio is the sound salvation. Radio is cleaning up the nation. They say you better listen to the voice of reason, but they don't give you any choice, 'cause they think that it's treason. So you would better do as you were told. You better listen to the radio. I wanna bite the hand that feeds me. I wanna bite that hand so badly. I wanna make them wish they'd never seen me. Some of my friends sit around every evening and they worry about the times ahead. But everybody else is overwhelmed by indifference and the promise of an early bed. You either shut up or get cut out. They don't want to hear about it. It's only inches on the reel to reel. And the radio is in the hands of such a lot of fools trying to understand the way that you feel. Radio is a sound salvation. Radio is cleaning up the nation. They say you better listen to the voice of reason, but they don't give you any choice, 'cause they think that it's treason. So you had better do as you were told. You better listen to the radio. Wonderful radio. Marvelous radio. Wonderful radio. Radio, radio. Radio, radio. Radio.
That was Weird Al Yankovic playing Radio Radio, which is wonderful to hear because I've never heard it before.
Oh, really?
I mean, I've heard Elvis Costello play it. I've not heard you play it. Al Yankovic, it is a pleasure and honor to have you here. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you.
And congratulations for 30 years.
Yay!
It's almost 30 years exactly that your first album came out, right?
That's true, yeah.
Do you figure 30 more years?
Well, yeah, at least, don't you think?
Sure. You know, Mick Jagger is almost 80, isn't he? And then the third Cyrus child. You know,
true.
Miley Jr.
The grandkid, of course.
Exactly. For all you longtime Weird Al fans who are now parents or grandparents, his new children's book is called My New Teacher and Me, and it is out this week. And Al, we have strategically placed an accordion, you may have noticed.
Oh, this thing.
This thing now in your lap.
Oh, what is that? Where'd that come from?
Would you be up for playing this out instrumentally as
just a little something? Okay.
Finish the show?
All right, here we go.
You can hear more of my conversation with Weird Al Yankovic at studio360.org and hear him play another classic from his back catalog, Buy Me a Condo. But that's it for this hour of Studio 360. Thanks very much for listening. And thanks to Random House Audio for the excerpt of Carl Hiaasen's Bad Monkey that you heard in today's show. And stay in touch with Studio 360 all during the week on Facebook, where you can talk to us about what we're doing on the show, what we should be doing, what we might do one day. Studio 360 is a co-production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Ital Malad,
David Krasnow,
Michelle Siegel,
Jenny Lawton,
John Delore,
Sean Ramosferam,
Alana Harper,
Anne Hepperman,
Eric Malinsky,
Chloe Plant,
Rachel Lewis Krisky,
Ellen Mayer,
Mark Sheely.
Thanks as ever to WNYC's Chris Bannon. Our theme music is by David Van Tegum.
Support for Studio 360 comes from the car company Scion, dedicated to supporting new talent. At the Scion Motivate Conference, 10 young entrepreneurs were awarded a car, capital, and mentoring. One awardee was Lilco, a letterpress and design studio in Dallas. Learn more at scion.com. Studio 360 is funded in part by the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art.
Beautiful!
PRI, Public Radio International.
Paul Feig, the director of Bridesmaids, has teamed up with Parks and Recreation writer Katie Dippold to make The Heat, a new buddy cop comedy starring Sandra Bullock and Melissa McCarthy.
I am a federal agent.
What are those?
They're Spanx. They're Spanx. They just hold everything together.
Why? What's going to come popping out?
The director and writer of The Heat, next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.